time is right, I'm gonna pack my bags and take that journey down the road. 'Cause over the mountain I see the bright sunshine, and I want to live inside the glow.
Morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Before the thon, before we delve into the pitchy world of fundraising, I'm not sure with the guest, Zach Zeiss, as his first novel. And before that, that person's right.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. At one point during Shin Godzilla, also known as Godzilla Resurgence, one of the seemingly many hundreds of main characters we're asked to follow notes that the giant creature rampaging its way across Tokyo in really impressive sequences that mix guys in rubber suits intricate model work and practical and CG effects is a perfect organism surpassing man. Now, I haven't been following the Godzilla franchise closely. My knowledge of the films is not encyclopedic by any stretch, but that sounds like something new to the canon, that a giant, lumbering, radiation-spewing lizard is not just a physical threat, but an existential one as well. That doesn't come as a surprise if you know the resume of one of the film's two directors. One of the directors is Shinji Higuchi, whose most recognizable works from an American standpoint are probably the anime series Nadia, Secret of the Blue Water, and the feature-length live-action adaptation of Attack on Titan. But the other director is Hideaki Anno, who's best known, and maybe notorious would be the better word, for the revolutionary Judeo-Christian-themed Mecha vs. Giant Monster anime series Neon Genesis Evangelion. Shin Godzilla isn't quite the same delirious mix of surreal monsters, governmental infighting, psychosexual drama, and warriors with extreme daddy issues, but it does reflect Anno's preference for focusing as much on human turmoil as monster mayhem. Neither the child-friendly camp of many of the early Godzilla films, the very first being a notable exception, nor the more action-oriented take that the American remakes have attempted, Shin Godzilla is actually a portrait of how a bureaucracy might respond to such a crisis, spending most of its screen time in meeting rooms, government offices, and hastily assembled think tanks as various representatives of the government assimilate the scale of the dilemma, weigh options, deal with the international repercussions. Not surprisingly, America casts a long shadow, both welcome and not, and yes, deploy cunningly targeted politics as frequently as they do armed forces. This is probably not going to please those who just want to see tanks, planes, and other assorted heavy armaments go up against the king of monsters, although it should be noted that the classic structure of a Godzilla film allows for long stretches where cities aren't being toppled. And Anno and Higuchi are maybe too avid in their prosaic approach to the genre, slapping identifying subtitles on practically every shot in the film, which I would be more annoyed about if I didn't suspect they had their tongues planted at least partially in their cheeks when they did it. Mostly, though, I found the ground-level take on the genre refreshing. As much as a film dealing with a giant, radioactive lizard can, this does capture what it might feel like to be in the room with the people tasked with handling the emergency. And while there are moments when the special effects feel a little static, which may be an artifact of both directors' anime background, when they do get moving, they are pretty astounding. Shin Godzilla takes a well-worn franchise and casts it in a new and quite credible light, and I love that. Speaking of bureaucracies, did you know that if you shrank yourself down and entered the brain of a pig, you'd discover an impressively organized office with little tiny pigs dutifully noting every memory and filing away binders full of them in library shelves? It's true. Or at least, that's one of the many revelations of A Town Called Panic Double Fun, a kind of sequel, actually a compilation of a pair of Christmas-themed and back-to-school-themed TV specials, to the very strange and very funny Belgian stop-motion animated film of a few years ago, A Town Called Panic. As with the feature, this is set in a universe of cheap but very idiosyncratic plastic toys, where it's not unusual to see a Russian cosmonaut giving geography lessons and a clutch of barnyard animals sharing the Christmas table with a farmer and his wife. These outings are a little less ambitious than the feature, with the high-spirited, childlike, and very self-centered cowboy and Indian conspiring to steal away a Christmas log dessert from the farmer and shrinking themselves down to raid the memory of a pig for the crucial test answer that will win them a trip to the moon. That's just scratching the surface of a film that lays on visual incongruities, slapstick, and chase sequences with wild abandon. Unfortunately, A Town Called Panic Double Fun's one theatrical run was this past weekend, but I am presuming it'll be getting a video release soon, and it is worth catching. In other Godzilla news, if you follow Kaiju, aka giant monster movies, close enough, you probably know that North Korea tried its hand at the genre with Pulgasauri. What you may or may not know was that the director of that film, Shin Sang-ok, was a South Korean director kidnapped by Kim Jong-il along with the director's superstar wife, Choi Eun-hee, in order to get the North Korean film industry onto the international stage. Yeah, turns out there are odder things in the history of film beyond Uwe Boll. The story of the filmmaking couple's snatching, imprisonment, and escape is being told in the new documentary The Lovers and the Despot. Directors Ross Adam and Robert Cannon use a collage of news footage, artfully aged dramatic reenactments, and clips from Shin's own films to recreate events that would be ludicrous. Turns out that with the indulgence of an admiring strongman, Shin was far more successful in captivity than he ever was in the South, if it wasn't all so horrifically true. The Lovers and the Despot shows what happens when your greatest fan also happens to be the psychotic ruler of one of the world's most hellish nations, and it is a fascinating chronicle of one of filmdom's stranger chapters. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote. There is still time. And let's defeat Trump.
Indeed, indeed. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The program, Hour of the Wolf, the name Jim Freund, the guest, Zach, I said Zeiss. No. You're not supposed to say it. You're supposed to spell it. It's Z-Y-Z. And exactly. E-Z-A-K.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, and I don't have your mic up. Hold on.
Indeed, you do not. There we are.
There you are.
All right. So, Ziggy, Ziggy, Ziggy. Zach, Z-Y-Z.
Yes.
No one can find me.
There we go. And this is your second time on the show. Third time in the studio, I think.
I believe so. Yeah, I think I was here with Margot Atwell when she was just rolling out her book, which is the first book from our publishing house, Gut Punch Press, which is called Derby Life, a crash course in the incredible sport of roller derby.
Yes, it has nothing to do with hats. No. When people talk about derby life, you know, it's not as opposed to Borsellino life.
It's a good hat, but I don't think you could sustain an entire book about derbies.
Well, who knows? Who knows? Philip K. Dick had short stories about shoes, so...
So, all right. That's a good lead on where. What was the short story about
the short
shoes?
Happy life of the brown Oxford?
Huh. I have not read this. I've read a bunch of Dick stuff, but I have never come across this guy that I can recall.
Yeah. It's actually the title of a collection of stories. There are five books that are the complete stories of Philip K. Dick, and that's volume five. And it's and they are very complete. They didn't say the good stories. although there are some, each book, it's dreadful because you have to shell out for each and every one. But I'm a completist anyway for certain things. I can't afford the Theodore Sturgeon set because that would come to over $200. But the Philip K. Dick set in trade paper will come to like a mere 70 or so. For you know, non-e-copy. And each of the five books have some really winning stories in them, a number of which people just don't know because they haven't yet. They're like the Dick wrote over 100 stories, and so far there are only about 15 films. They're already remaking.
I would give it time. There's some that just definitely will not make it into a film. Like, some of his stuff is too far out. I don't think they'll ever make some of it.
You know, I used to say that. But a book that, a fantasy novel, which is one of my favorite books, and I will mention it because the author just died, Shoeless Joe, by W.P. Kinsella, Bill Kinsella, Canadian writer, and is about a guy in a cornfield in Iowa, who's, here's a voice that says, if you build it, he will come. And so this fellow, who, to let's distinguish, is not named Bill Kinsella, but is Ray Kinsella, goes and he finds, dot, 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 J.P. Salinger. And he kidnaps J.D. Salinger, and they spend most of the novel talking about Catcher in the Rye and about literary stuff. The James Earl Jones character into the this is a brilliant book that could just not make it as a film, and it didn't. The adaptation of the film is brilliant by Phil Alden Robinson, I think, if I remember that correctly, and it's genius. He took an unfilmable novel because it's too much about literary traits and talking about books and talking about baseball and the inner life of each of these and how they relate to each other, including a lot about Catcher in the Rye, which has, you know, no pun about Catcher.
Yeah.
Although there are a couple within the book. And you read that and you say, somebody's going to make a movie of this. You go, no. Can't be any good. And yet Field of Dreams is a fine film. And it's an unfilmable novel. All
right. I'll bring up another unfilmable novel that I do expect that at some point somebody will adapt if they haven't already done it. I'm a fool if they've already done it. But another film that begins in a field, a classic Olaf Stapledon, The Star Maker.
Yes.
And I think I was reading a blog the other day, and the name escapes me now, and they had a Star Maker quote right at the top of it. And immediately it's like, I've got to read what this guy has to say. Just something about that book. I've never read somebody who was enthusiastic about this book that they didn't have some very strange ideas and things worth hearing. It's just such an incredible
Stapledon
book.
Stapledon in general is like that. Here at WBAI, before I worked here and I started in 1967, we did Last and First Men. The whole thing, just, you know, reading it on the air before there were audiobooks, before any of that, before books on tape. Baird Searles brought the art of reading science fiction on the air to WBAI. He also kept doing radio drama at a time when radio drama was dead. And he had Samuel R. Delaney producing and directing his own work, and some guy named Sturgeon, and Tom Dish, and the script girl, that was the title she had, was Joanna Russ. And these people were all working at BAI when I started in 67, which is why I basically dropped out of school to stay here, and still here. But anyhow, Stapledon.
What a master.
Absolutely. A name that is not recalled, his stuff is probably horrifyingly out of print.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I think the first time I read it, I was about 16 years old, and I picked up, I think, one of those, like, world's greatest science fiction whatever. Mm-hmm. I think they did a series of 50 books. I can't recall the publisher off the top of my head.
May have been Golentz.
I believe it definitely Golentz. So they included him in their, like, world's greatest or ultimate science fiction or whatever. And I remember reading this book and cracking the cover and thinking, ah, this is so Victorian. I'll never get through this. And
it's
written in a very
read.
It's written in the initial part of the story is written in this very sort of polite turn of the century type way. I believe Stapledon, like an ambulance driver in World War I, and has some of those same sensibilities. And you start reading into the story, and you're like, "Well, I couldn't possibly be interested in this." And like, why is this guy just being swept up? There's no explanation for why he's swept up into view the entirety of the universe. He just walks out into a field, and then ascends, and not to give any spoilers or anything like that, but witnesses the entire birth and death of the universe in the course of a summer evening. And Stapledon's imagination is unparalleled. At the time, I've never since read anything that just floored me the way that this book just knocked me flat on my ass.
The thing that comes closest to my mind, and I haven't seen the film, so I shouldn't talk too freely. Now I'm blanking on it. Was his last movie, or movie before last, Tree of Life?
Oh, I watched
starring Brad Pitt.
I really enjoyed. So Tree of Life, the very initial sequence of Tree of Life. I went into Tree of Life, and everybody I went in with was just baffled.
And who's the director?
I should cannot, know this. I feel like any guess that I make would be totally inappropriate. So Tree of Life. Tree of Life has like a very...
Who directed Tree of Life?
All right, while we wait for the Oracle.
You go ahead, because...
It has a sequence where it's just going through sort of the rise of multicellular life and dinosaurs.
Terrence Malick.
Yeah, I think it was like the first thing he had done in quite some time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's not a fast... He doesn't churn them out. He's sort of like Kubrick.
Yeah. So it has like a very interesting sequence there, but just in term, like I would, I almost never dare to dream of writing at the scope that he writes at there, and he just does such a fantastic job. There's so many interesting conceptions that he brings forth, and this is a guy that's writing Star Maker at, when was Star Maker published? But it was like very, very, very prior to, you know. He's not standing on this.
Somebody is texting me.
They're letting you know now?
Yes. Okay. SF Masterworks.
Yep.
Okay. And a person on Facebook is saying Star Maker is still in print from Gallants.
All right. Well,
yeah, which I'm not surprised at. And it was one of their SF Masterworks series.
Yeah. So, but to conclude that thought, like he, at the time, he wasn't standing on the shoulders of giants. He was the giant.
Yes.
And I feel like echoes of his work have just gone through years and years and years. So if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. It's definitely worth plowing through.
Anything with Stapleton's name on it. But if, you know, that's another unfilmable, but I could imagine a Terrence Malick, a true visionary, making a noble attempt at adaptation. It cannot be.
I'd like to see David Lynch take a crack at it and really mess it up.
Well, you see,
just terribly.
Yeah, people are down on Dune, but I actually
I like the David Lynch Dune. Yeah,
yeah. I'm one of the very few people who saw the treatment of David Lynch's Dune, which was set to be a 7-hour movie.
Wow.
And, you know, unfortunately, he was working with the De Laurentiis family, and the project taken away from him before Final Cut. Mm. And they just chopped it down. And they later came out with, it was released at 2:20. And they later came out with a 2-hour, 40-minute version. Still not what Lynch had in mind. Lynch, of course, took his name off the film and put on the name directed by Judas Priest.
Judas Priest.
Yeah. For some reason, the Directors Guild didn't allow him to use...
He couldn't use the regular pseudonym
for
when you drop... What is that name? You drop yourself, it's like A. Smith or...
There's a famous...
The duress name that directors will use.
Yeah. And I'm blanking on it at the moment.
Same.
He was not able to get... I think he waited too long. I think you have to register with Directors Guild to use that name within a certain period of time, and he took too long to do it. So he was not allowed to use that pseudonym. But
Judas, it's a solid choice.
It came out as Judas Priest. And I also understand why he screwed up the Baron Harkonnen. Because Frank Herbert screwed up the Baron Harkonnen, in my opinion.
How so?
The only thing in the book that makes the Baron Harkonnen more evil than House Atreides is that the Baron Harkonnen lusts after his nephew, Fade Rautha, which is to say, Sting.
Yeah.
in the movie.
I always kind of like that. I thought that.
But that's the thing that makes him evil in Herbert's mind. Read that into reread mm-hmm. the book. It's always worth rereading. It's a great novel.
So he just uses, like, basically Harkonnen's proclivities are the only thing that really separates him from the Atreides.
But I think that Herbert had a certain amount of homophobia, and the fact that he lusted after this male family member is the thing that distinguished him as being evil.
Yeah, I guess
so. David Lynch made him a bloodsucker instead, because Lynch took a look and said, "Really, there's nothing worse from the Harkonnens than there is with House Atreides." So, Lynch went, I think, a little overboard with his portrayal. I love the performance, but it's hard to watch.
Yeah, when they pull out the heart plug and everything like
that. Yeah, exactly.
That's definitely, and the weird disease that he has and the treatments that he's receiving. I mean, all these elements of the film were they left a lasting impression. I think I was about 8 years old when I saw it. So that's one of those things that sticks with you.
But that's the thing, is that all we know is that Harkonnen is the Baron is supposed to be exceedingly evil. And if you read the book, especially with today's sensibilities, mm-hmm. you don't see where the evil lies, other than the narrator tells you he's evil.
Well, the narrator in Dune has like a very pro-Atreides bent. I always see.
Well, it's the princess Irulan.
Yeah,
is the writer of.
Book. That's true. Sure,
told from her point of view, but she is also Herbert's voice.
I had a Dune moment this week. Actually, went on a date with this girl who. Was sort of, everything about her was as if calculated to completely ensnare me. Like everything that I would look for, everything that I would find like interesting, and I went into it and I'm like, this is a trap. You know, I've been set up by the Ixians here. This is too good to be true. And of course it was, but just like Leto too, I was willing to walk into those jaws knowing that things would go wrong. I think I remarked to a friend, I was like, this is my Hui Nori, and absolutely was. And I was cut apart by lasgun fire and fell into a river, and that was the end for me.
There you go.
Alas.
But anyhow, that's my opinion. Outside of that, I thought Lynch's vision was pretty good. I loved the performances.
Very good performances. I will even grant him like all the weird symbology that he throws in there, the cutaways to like hands and disembodied faces and the weird voices echoing in the background. Like, I'm willing to buy all that. I'll sign on.
The Bene Gesserit.
Yeah.
People, it's not that long ago since I last broadcast my interview with Frank Herbert. And I did just when Children of Dune came out. And Margot Adler joined me for the last part of that interview. And it's very revealing and a lot of fun. And I was just talking and geeking with, oh my God, I've got Frank Herbert in the room. And he was on a book tour, so he was just, you know, not even necessarily that cognizant, just surprised to know that I really knew and I got the idea that, you know, I understood the puns in the book where one of the bibliographic characters, Ander Paulson, was Paul Anderson and stuff like that. And
That's pretty solid. I did not pick up on that on my first reading.
Well, to me it was obvious since I'd probably seen Paul at a con the week before. I'm older than you, and
I have shelved enough Poole Anderson books in my life. I used to work at a used bookstore, like many people who wind up writing fantasy and science fiction. Mm-hmm. And I get Hugh Howey and like a ton of other people. It's just we all want like spend so long shelving those books, and finally we're like, I can do that.
Yeah,
you know. And then I've seen Poole Anderson's name and Piers Anthony and like all these names.
I've never met Piers Anthony, But Poole I would see at cons. And
well, he might just be a pseudonym.
And his
for
wife
Poole
and
Anderson.
His daughter.
Yeah.
You know,
so in the book that I'm, I guess, ostensibly promoting, Xana Naik, the new book, I rip Herbert off to some extent. Like, one of the main focal points of the book are these enormous insecting, many-segmented creatures with, like, an almost godlike intelligence called the Bashiskyla. And just sort of one of the key points of the book is these four foolish adventurers have been duped by a witch into venturing into the Kalparsimix, which is an insect jungle just rife with all forms of pestilence and monstrous insects and danger at every turn. And they've gone in to lure one of these giant creatures out with the idea that they can bring it back to a region that's beset by an insect plague, and it will eat everything in sight and devour all of the creatures called tinks, which are besieging the land. And if that sounds like a absolutely terrible idea to you, it is. So, yeah, tiny segue from Dune there, but like that huge influence on me.
An appropriate one, because we are here to talk about this being your first novel.
Yes.
Not your first book, but your first novel.
First novel length. It's not actually the first novel that I've written, but it's certainly the first one that I had the stamina to actually finish editing. Okay. It's always been a sore point for me.
It's your first published novel.
This will be the first published novel.
So from the point of view of the world, this is your first novel.
I think I had to write 5 books to get to where I could publish one.
Yeah, I think that's not unusual.
Not unusual, but still heartbreaking.
Well,
every single time.
It's a lot of work, and, you know, guess what, people? You don't make a living doing it,
either. No. Well, you never know. I could be the first. That'd be really nice. The realities of publishing are...
Yeah, I mean, the first is like Stephen King.
Yeah. Know?
And I met him just when Carrie had come out. So he was a superstar at that point, and I didn't know who he was. He and I went with 2 other people to shoot pinball at a con outside Sandusky, Ohio.
Wow. So that must have been before
very small convention.
Before his body became about 70% cocaine.
Yeah,
so.
I imagine...
There's another like
I don't know.
Interesting arc.
We went to a bar and we shot pinball, and he did very, very well
at the pinball.
So he, I just know this tall guy named Steve, and Steven, and he went to the bartender and he said, "Look, I got your high score." And the bartender just took a look at it and said, "Yeah, here you go," and gave him money.
Money.
Yes, we did not realize that like in olden days in New York, until LaGuardia stopped it, pinball is used for gambling.
Mm-hmm.
High scores earn money. And this was true in Ohio at the time. Don't know if it was legal or not.
Gotcha.
But they were paying out. And so the guy paid King, and the 4 of us, Jack Chalker was among them, and this is before Jack had written A Word of Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
He was a publisher at the time of a small press called Mirage Press, and he and I used to go to a lot of cons together, splitting costs and stuff, even though Jack lived in Baltimore, and I was here, but I don't recall who the 4th person was. It was Jack's car. And when we drove back to the convention, we had gotten there a day early, so this was the Friday. Steven is there, tallest and most noticeable among the group, and all of a sudden, all these people are like shoving copies of books in his face to autograph. And that's how I found out this guy was Stephen King.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, but all I know is how he played pinball.
Let me ask you something. What is your favorite Stephen King book?
I'm not a huge Stephen King fan.
But is there one that you like out of... So
The Body?
The Body's here. Okay, so
and it's a story. It's a novella.
Yeah.
It's also my favorite movie adaptation of his work. The Shining notwithstanding. But The Shining is Kubrick, so that's something, you know, Kubrick.
Yes, it's another level there.
It's another whole other level. But what Rob Reiner did with Stand By Me.
Oh, yeah, Stand By Me.
Is based on The Body.
So out of that book, Different Seasons was the collection. And in Different Seasons, there's a preface to Different Seasons, like, where he's basically gloating to all of his friends who are like, why do you bother with these short stories, Stephen? They don't make any money. And he's like, well, you know, I wrote them anyways, and they're coming out now. And so, ha ha ha, you know, I got them published after all. So I did make some money on these short stories. And in Different Seasons, the short story that became the movie At Pupil, which is not stellar by any means, but also in it.
Oh, it's
Rita Hayworth. It's interesting. It's worth the story was worth a read. I feel like the movie maybe
the movie
maybe not,
is worth a watch, especially if you're an X-Men fan.
Okay,
you know, to follow the career of the director.
Okay,
Brian. The fellow did the first two.
Gotcha.
X-Men film and basically the Chris Claremont books.
Gotcha.
That became the X-Men movies.
So in that is The Body, which becomes Stand By Me, and a little story called Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption. So in this one book of novellas, you have just some incredibly powerful movies that
he made his money back.
Yeah, he is definitely worth his
time.
He
gets good adaptations for the most part. He gets a few crappy ones.
But, yeah, it's hit and miss. Like, but so mine is The Stand.
Mm-hmm.
I think
most people would regard that.
And I even like the sort of TV adaptation of it. I'll watch through the entire thing. Yeah.
The terrible admission is I haven't read The Stand, and I do understand that to be probably his best written work.
He's done like quite a few things that I think are worth reading, and a tremendous amount that's probably not as worth reading unless you're a huge fan of Stephen King.
I've read some stuff that annoyed me.
Definitely.
Because
I read like a few things.
Some of the Richard Bachman works.
Yeah. But I honestly...
And those were adapted for movies.
For my money, even if somebody just churns out mediocre work after mediocre work for their entire life, if they put out one thing that's just really stellar that I like, then that person has completely redeemed themselves. All I ask from anybody is to put out one thing that's really good over their entire career. And then after that, you know, I'm never going to look at that person and be like, wow, they're a hack, you know, or whatever. If you've got that one shining moment in your catalog, I can't hate you. Mm-hmm. I think that's all any of us can really hope for. Well, it's certainly all I can hope for, to tell you the truth. But
one never knows.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes there. Yeah.
So the book at hand.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this come from?
So this is Zan and Ink.
Spell that for the people who aren't watching their radios.
For those of you out there in radio land, that's X-A-N. And then there's an ampersand, or I think the print edition, if you're looking for it on Amazon or something like that, will be the word and, because it's easier to search for, and Ink. So Zan and Ink. And so this all started as a D&D campaign, believe it or not. I had to come up with a character for a campaign that we were playing at the Google headquarters, and I came up with the idea.
This is New York headquarters?
This is a New York headquarters of Google, and which is not their headquarters per se, but...
Well, they call it that, but I like to distinguish because...
Not out in Palo Alto.
Yeah.
So, so I came up with the idea for a thief who had broken into the lair of a wizard and stolen a forbidden scroll. And as she was trying to make off with this guy's scroll, the wizard comes upon her and tries to struggle. The two of them fight. She winds up slitting his throat. And then, as she's trying to make her escape, she realizes that his curse has fallen over her. And she has lost all color and has just become a completely black silhouette. Everything. Eyes, teeth, everything. And what's more, everything that she touches turns black as well. And so this was the initial character prompt that I intended to run through this campaign. I thought it was like a neat little curse. And I think I was hiking on the Appalachian Trail, and I got the idea for a kind of like weird tree scorpion where it would fling spines from its tail, and the spines would actually be sort of its way of having its offspring gestate in the corpse of something. I think I was looking at a wasp or something like that on the AT while we were hiking around. And somehow those two ideas joined together to turn into this book. So if you like curses and black magic and weird bugs that are just absolutely vicious and terrifying, then yeah, it's a pretty solid read. It's a standalone. So it's about 274 pages, and I did not want to.
Any idea?
I want to say that Zan and Ink is about 90,000 words.
Okay, that's so, proper novel length.
Yeah, it's novel length, but we wanted to put out something that was relatively brisk and approachable, because in that same world, all the other books written in this world are super long. I want to say that the next one in the series, which we'll probably put out, is called Rapazorus. It's about an interdimensional dungeon, and it's 666 pages long. And then the one that's after that, I don't even know how long the books will be, because it's 240,000 words right now, and unfortunately you can't print that in a book, so we have to break it up into different volumes. I'm sorry, I hate...
Well, that's what happened to Tolkien, after
all. I hate to do a trilogy.
Yeah, but Tolkien didn't want to do a trilogy, and he didn't.
Yeah.
He wrote one book,
yep,
one novel called Lord of the Rings, which the publisher, George Allen Unwin, turned into three volumes against Tolkien's wishes.
Yeah, I understand the necessity, and from a marketing standpoint, trilogies are definitely better. But for me personally, I don't want to pick up a book and know that three volumes of The Seven Plan have been written. I want to know that it's a completed work. I want to know that almost all of my questions will be answered or intentionally unanswered. I'm happy with either. And I love like Game of Thrones, and I've read Wheel of Time, and I like these books, but the element of them being so episodic and broken up has always grated at me.
Wheel of Time,
George
Martin
one, yeah,
had an idea, mm-hmm, where he was going to end up with the Fire and Ice books when he started it. But Jordan just... I got bored by book three on Wheel of Time because... to me, it was simply, okay, first book is forest, second book is desert, mm-hmm, third book is water, but it was the same book.
Yeah, I felt like I had read
roll of the dice.
Just about everything that I needed to in the first two books with Wheel of Time. And, nothing against fans of Wheel of Time.
It was a real page-turner, I have to say. But after a while, as I was turning the pages, I realized I've been here before.
So, just going from Wheel of Time, I feel like one person who does a really good job of kind of keeping it fresh and like making me feel like in a second book, there's more going on there. Brandon Sanderson, who was just like
a real workhorse.
I just from a craft perspective, just looking at sort of his work ethic, the way that he just puts out those words,
it's,
and their writing is solid.
I'm going to say something terrible.
It's, and the ideas are great.
It's these Mormons who write science fiction and fantasy. And Scott Card is a great craftsperson.
Yeah.
Whatever one may think of his politics, he is a brilliant craftsperson and a good writer. Mm-hmm. He makes easy reads and valuable reads, yeah, as long as they're fiction. And Brandon Sanderson as well. Only I don't dislike Brandon Sanderson.
Yeah, well,
but no, there are, it's amazing how many people that were born into and came out of Mormon tradition have become good science fiction writers.
I wonder if Robert Silverberg has some like distant Mormon relative somewhere in the tree. Because when I think about super prolific writers, he's up there on the list, like Silverberg.
Yeah, but no, as far as I know, he...
Yeah, I've just the idea of him... Because I, on a good day, I think I can write like for about 4 hours. And then I'm at the end of it, I'm fried. And he would just sit down every day and just crank it out for 8-10 hours a day. And that's what he did. He's a machine. And I envy that kind of ethic. I've been trying to get to that point for 20 years, and I'm only halfway there.
And there's somebody whose work, especially some of his short stories, like Passengers, mm-hmm. and which has nothing to do with any movie by the name Passengers, mm-hmm. but some of his shorter works are screaming to be adapted.
Did they ever make a, and I hate to jump to like one of his more famous work, but did they ever make anything out of Dying Inside?
No.
See, that's one where there's so much potential.
Yeah, a lot of his writing, to my knowledge, he has never been successfully adapted, even in the short form.
I love the melancholy,
not even in the second neurotic tone Zone series
of Robert Silverberg's work. I really enjoy
when the
reading
editor
his stuff,
of the first season was Harlan Ellison, and the second two seasons was George Martin. People forget that Twilight Zone. Wow. And I don't know why, because there's some brilliant stuff in there. Really decent. They did some Zelazny. They did all kinds of good stuff. But as far as I know, Silverbob has never been properly adapted.
Now, there's a gold mine there, or a silver mine, I guess, for somebody that's willing to dig into that work. And it's just, I feel like the time may be right for a revival of that, because they're really that kind of like sad, introspective.
Well, we'll see, because the movie that I am most hopeful for is Arrival, starring Amy Adams. But aside that, it's based on a Ted Chiang story mm-hmm. called Story of Your Life. Ted Chiang, one of the very, very few writers who have never published a novel. He's only written short stories, and every time he does, it wins all the appropriate awards, and deservedly so. He's a brilliant, brilliant writer, and somehow somebody took one of his novellas and turned it into a movie, which people are saying, forget Interstellar. This is serious, brilliant, intellectual, exciting, good, hard science fiction.
Mm. No, I have to look
and it
at
opens
there.
Next month.
I hadn't even heard about it. I'll have to go watch. I seldom get out to see movies anymore.
The trailers are out there. It's called Arrival. And, you know, go to YouTube and watch the trailer. And I'll see almost any movie with Amy Adams. Nice. And she did one of my favorite science fiction films of the last 10 years, Her.
Oh.
Vastly underrated film.
Okay. Well, one of the things I've noticed...
By the way, I don't mean to interrupt because we're having a great conversation. Yeah. I am willing to go ahead and just chat, but we have a little more than half an hour left.
Okay. Well,
So the question is, if you want to read, now is the time, or we can continue having this chat, which is fine by me, and we'll just promote the book more.
Well, I tell you what, I would like to read a bit of Xananik, if only for the practice there. One of the things that I actually recently picked this up, because I was thumbing through the book, looking at our proofs, and I said, geez, from now on, every time I write a book, I'm going to go through every line of dialogue in that book, and I'm going to read it aloud.
You should rule of thumb, not just the dialogue. Always good to read an entire book.
I definitely think so, because I looked at one line in there, and I was just like, you know what? Would somebody really talk this much at this point in meeting some people? And I had to like really think about it. So, and this just struck me. You know, I'm still learning how to do all this.
Depends on the character.
I didn't take any classes. This is literally just a guy wandering into a coffee shop and sitting down and filling notebook after notebook after notebook, and getting like some very excellent editing. But I've never taken like a clarion course. I didn't graduate high school. I'm very much
you and me both, huh?
Yeah, very much from the like.
Well, what was your top grade?
I think I made it to 10th grade before I was expelled. So did I beat you?
I was 9th.
Nice.
And they were going to leave me back.
Yeah, they're going to.
And I was already working at BAI, so I was just cutting classes at that point. So I went into the 10th grade, but I never finished it.
I got expelled for running a gambling and boxing ring. You're not allowed to do that, apparently.
No. I just came here.
And then after I got expelled, I started hitchhiking cross country, and the rest is history. It's just like.
And you're still a traveler.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Everywhere
last
I can go.
Last time I saw you was at ReaderCon, and you'd just gotten off your motorbike.
Oh, well, it sounds like we're just going to chat at this point, because now
I'm
interested.
I'll let you do it.
No, honestly, I'd much rather chat this point, because these are stories I want to tell. So, I'm a big fan of motorcycles, and I think prior to ReaderCon, I went to a convention up in the Adirondacks called AdamCon, which is a small gathering of friends. It's run by a guy named Adam Siegel. Who is? I mentioned
from
him earlier.
Name, it had to be someone named Adam.
Yeah, definitely. There are actually multiple Adams there.
Fred, you know.
So he is a world champion of the game Diplomacy, which is a board game, extremely cutthroat.
It's almost not a board game.
Yeah, it's almost like
when I played Diplomacy, and I'm not a big gamer, but I played Diplomacy. And you had to be in the room, and not that many cards were involved.
No. Yeah, it's much more, it's a negotiation game when it really comes down to it. Negotiation and sort of playing off of other people. So they've done conference up in the Adirondacks every couple of years, and it is a fantastic time. It's invite only. It's a small gathering of friends, a lot of like very smart people, some people who work at Google, some people who work at other tech companies, lawyers, doctors, and some bums that kind of wander in off of the streets.
Pretty much
yours
everybody
truly.
There could do a TED Talk.
Yeah, absolutely. So a fantastic group of people, just really a good group of friends and everything. So it was a whole weekend of just playing high-end board games. You may know that I don't think I've mentioned it here, but I run a board gaming society in New York called Strategically Correct. And we like to collect the most bloodthirsty players that we can possibly get and sort of turn them loose against each other. So anyhow, I had just gone to this conference up in the Adirondacks where it's absolutely beautiful over the 4th of July weekend. And my goal was to then spend the next 2 weeks sort of trying to get over a failed relationship by just driving on the motorcycle. And I didn't bring a map, and I turned off my phone, and I would just point in a direction every morning, and it wound up taking me considerable ways up the coast. But I had no idea how beautiful parts of Connecticut and New York were.
New England.
New England is gorgeous.
New York.
Yeah,
I mean, you go to upstate New York,
it's
New England. I don't care what people say. Oh, no, you're in the mid-Atlantic. I don't care.
No, it's... The thing was, it was just, you could just walk through there, and you know, at the time I was getting over like a pretty serious breakup of a number of years, and you can't be sad if you're just going through a stretch of the country that's just jaw-droppingly beautiful.
Now that was in the early summer, mm-hmm. but the time to go to upstate New York is now, as the colors of the trees are changing. Yeah. It's October country.
So I had planned to take a motorcycle trip up there to see the colors. I want to go
get
up
some apples
through Vermont and everything like that. But unfortunately, I was just in a pretty significant bike wreck, which if you ride a motorcycle, it's just, unfortunately, it's a matter of time until you get into a wreck. And, you know, the severity of it is just a function of how careful you are. And more than anything, your luck, you know.
Yeah, because in a motorcycle, it's just, you don't have... I was in one serious accident in my life. It was in a car, and the car acted as a cage.
Yeah, there's no cage in the cycle.
Yeah, exactly. So I was fairly well protected. Motorcycles don't have those balloons that come out and either help you or kill you, depending on who made them.
But, I mean, there's always a trade-off for freedom. Like, if you want to be free, the trade-off is that you're not safe. You can't have the two. You can't be totally free and totally safe.
Or you can end up like the people in Easy Rider.
Yeah, absolutely. Some degenerate hillbilly that just takes off the top of your head with the shotgun because he wants to.
Although the protagonists of Easy Rider are pretty degenerate themselves.
I like it's a good degeneracy, though.
Oh, come on. They're ripping off everybody. On route, they rip off the hippies. I got to tell you,
one of my favorite books of all time is Jean Steinbeck's Tortilla Flat.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote about this recently. I was doing like a question and answer, and they asked about my favorite books. And I talked about they just have like a decent indecency to them. And just the main characters are these characters called paisanos who just will steal anything that is not nailed down, like whether it's a jug of wine or a vacuum cleaner or Torelli's wife. And just that sort of like laissez-faire steal anything ethic has always been really appealing to me. I've always liked, and this is like a recurring trope, but there are a lot of movies that just have somebody who just likes taking things that don't belong to them. And that character is always super interesting to me.
It's just Easy Rider. I think it's actually intentional. I think it was intentional on Dennis Hopper's part. I'm not sure. That these guys, they're not just stealing stuff. They're ripping off nice people. They treat them badly.
No, absolutely.
They treat people badly. They're not nice folk.
See, I identify with characters like that. Because I don't think that the characters in Easy Rider are pitch black either. I mean, there's definitely...
No, they're not.
There's good parts of them as well.
They're the protagonists of the film, but they're not the heroes.
I talked about this with my editor recently, and we were talking about characters that I've written. She edited just an enormous amount of my books. Super talented. This is Margot Atwell, who I can't speak highly enough of. And we were talking about it,
The phrase? I always say it wrong. It's not. She's not a roller derby queen. She's a roller derby.
So I'm not sure.
She lives the derby life.
Yeah, she's a superstar.
Once upon a time, we just called them being the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
They were all called derby queens. That was the phrase in that era. It has the Gotham girls are the next generation.
Yep. So her team actually won their championship this year. The Manhattan Mayhem were the New York champions. It's an exciting game. It's really fun to watch. Huh? Yeah, it's been a couple of years since Manhattan fans.
I watched a couple of them on like late night former UHF channels that are now obscure cable channels. You can catch some of their games.
I love this, like late night channels, the weird call in shows and stuff like that. It's just I don't know if you ever. So back when I was a kid, I used to read, and I'm afraid that I can only remember this. It's like Daniel Pinkwater. Mm-hmm. I want to say is his name, but he had a book called Lizard Music. I don't know. Have you ever read this book?
No, I haven't. But I've read some Pinkwater. I've listened to him on the radio.
He is a real gem. Like actually, a lot of his books are just really really funny.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
This one was about a weird TV station, and this kid would stay up late and watch it, and just lizards would come on and play instruments. And it's a children's book, and just the concept really resonated with me for years to come. But yeah, that's like one of those books that if I have kids, I'll have them read if at all possible. It was just such a weird, crazy book about sort of a kid who's staying at home. And just starts investigating the mystery of lizards that show up on public access TV in the middle of the night. It's super fantastic there. I think I took that motorcycle ride and wound up at ReaderCon.
Avocado of Death.
Avocado of Death.
I'm just looking him up and I'm remembering stuff I've read. I read Avocado of Death. I did not read The Snarkout Boys.
I didn't read that one. Worms of Cookham Lima, actually, we talked about it earlier. So one of the key points of The Worms of Cookham Lima, which I remember seriously, is it's set in Africa. And this guy won't help them out unless they get him a pinball machine. And there's a long segment in there about how this old African dude just becomes a master of the pinball machine, like nudging it and shouting at it and just sort of getting the feel for it. Yeah, I wonder, everybody I know who is, I mean, maybe just everybody likes pinball, but definitely there are more science fiction and fantasy people that are deep into pinball. And I wonder what exactly it is that appeals to people. Specifically in that demo there. There's a really good convention that I've been to a few times. This is another small invite-only convention. People invite me to do these. I don't want to be like, oh, super snooty about, oh, they're invite-only or whatever. They're just groups of friends that throw conventions. And one is in Ocean City, New Jersey. And there are arcades there where you can still go, and they'll have 20 or 30 pinball machines lined up.
Yeah.
They can play them all for a quarter still to this day. I don't know how they stay in business. Maybe it's because the town is dry and people need something to do.
And also the maintenance of those machines is a big deal.
Yeah, it's a huge deal.
I had a pinball designer, a major pinball designer on the show a couple of times. Roger
really?
Sharp, yeah.
What tables did he design?
Oh, he worked for Williams.
Williams, okay. Yeah, and Williams has had some great tables, yeah.
I mean, this is the 70s. Which is, you know, the point at which you could still find four or five major pinball arcades in New York. When BAI was located on 8th Avenue, there was an arcade still in Penn Station. And with my show starting at 5 a.m., I would often be shooting pinball from about, like, midnight to 3 a.m.
Oh, that's amazing. Williams, I think, put out the Black Knight machine,
yes.
Which is the first machine that I ever... I personally feel like I mastered. I don't have like a world high score or anything like that. And then
I was never great at it. I just enjoyed the hell out of it.
Oh, to me, like if I'm going to play a table seriously, I want to get the high score on the machine. I want to know all the nuances, the infinite loops, everything that you can do to win at pinball. My favorite table of all time is I think Gottlieb's or maybe it's Gold Team. I can't remember how to say it. Cue Ball Wizard, which had actual cue ball on the playing field. I used to play that.
He has a son named Zach, by the way, Roger Sharp.
Does he really know?
Yeah. I'm just looking it up.
I used to play that at this pool hall in
his son
Northern Virginia.
Number 5 and number 19 in the World Pinball Player Ranking.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I can't believe that they have all this information. Oh, this isn't Wikipedia. This is a pinball wikia.
Pinball wikia.
Yeah, and it says Roger is one of the most idolized people in the pinball community. He's most famous for his work with legalizing pinball by proving it is a game of skill. Because
was he one of the people? Was he the guy
that they
brought in the table? And oh, that's amazing!
In 1976, Roger Sharp stood before the New York City Council with all the pressure in the world on his shoulders. As far as these people are concerned, he explained that if he pulled the plunger back just the right amount, the ball would go in a certain lane. He pulled back the plunger, the ball, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The head of the council announced that he had seen enough and pinball was soon legal. And there were pinball arcades, but they were putting out a lot of things that weren't pinball. The pinball machines were in the back.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I remember you would always have like in...
Chicago
I grew up in the 80s.
Legal. Chicago is, you know, hell, what are you doing? You gave me a fright.
Good God.
No, it's not good God. It's Lister.
Oh, see.
Leaning over his head showing up with his dreadlocks.
I didn't even notice him. I was so busy thinking
your
about
back
pinball.
Is
yeah.
To him, but I just saw this disembodied hand.
Oh, I remember this character. He's a good show. I like listening to him. Yeah.
Wonderful.
But
they don't tell us
what he created.
I mean, he's written the book. And in fact, when his book came out is when he was on my show. And we hung out for a little while. We went to the Times Square area and went to several arcades.
That's fantastic.
And at that time, I had this idea, this dream in my head that I would open up a classy, very classy arcade that you'd pay like a monthly or annual membership to be a member of. And it would serve drinks. It would, which is one reason why you had to be a member, and food and stuff like that. It would be similar to a bowling alley kind of environment, but it would just be pinball, and it would be more upscale than a bowling. But nowadays, some bowling alleys are upscale.
They absolutely are. I believe, and I may be wrong, and it may no longer be extant, but I believe that somebody set something similar up in New York, and I recently tried to go there with a friend, and it just wound up not working out. But I believe that there is a sort of pinball club in New York where you play hourly, or you pay hourly and just play X amount of pinball, however much you want.
Like
yeah,
like for a bowling alley.
Yeah. Like for a bowling alley or whatever. And I think their tables are meant to be like fairly well maintained. I'll look it up at some point there. But I'm a little sad. But obviously not surprised at the direction tables are going. I'm a big fan of electromechanical stuff. Yeah. I'm not super huge on like LED displays or just like lights and stuff like that. What is always, like, I played a game in Jersey called Junkyard, which had like a actual like physical wrecking ball that was a pinball on a little chain, and you would like knock it into these buildings and like cars and stuff like that and smash them over and everything. I'm sure that the maintenance on that thing must be outlandish to keep it going. But to me, the neat thing about pinball was always kind of like that Rube Goldberg-esque aspect. Yes. Of things are physically happening on a board. You're seeing changes there.
And I like the multi-level games.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Love extra levels and stuff like that.
Underneath the board or sometimes, you know, into a higher plane, literally.
Yeah, absolutely.
And play that at the top. Well, how about like video pinball games? Are you into any of those?
What did I play? I played, I remember the one that I liked the best was not Space Cadet Pinball, but there was like a 3D... space pinball that came out where you were like on Mars and they had gliders and stuff like that I thought was fantastic. But that would have been like I guess mid-90s that I was big into that, and the name escapes me there. But I don't know, I'd love to see sort of a revival in pinball, even if there were just like a few boutique designers that were just getting together.
Yeah,
and putting out like
Are there
single tables?
Are there companies, as you know, Bally or Williams? Are any of them still around?
I want to say, who's the big one right now? They put out Kiss Pinball and it's a shame too, because
they would have to be out of Chicago.
Yeah,
they all were.
There's one company that's still putting out stuff pretty regularly.
Chicago,
yeah. Let me see. I can't remember the name of I think there's basically just one big company that's still putting out tables. And there was like a little sort of renaissance in interest, and I think it's slacking off again.
So Zen and Ink.
Yeah, absolutely.
Getting back to the topic. I mean, you know, your first novel is out, so
yeah. I really have just been reminiscing about pinball for about 20 minutes.
It's wonderful, you know, and I can do it with you because I've been there, and I play a lot of the. There is a platform where you can actually.
MAME, yeah, where you can play all the different tables and stuff.
No, it's a different platform. There are several actually, but it's one that's on the Steam platform within, and there is it XO? I don't remember the name.
I remember playing something for Wii that was similar to that. But
they have well over 50 tables.
Yeah, I'll look into it there. That seems super fun. So this book has sort of a lot of interesting components to it. And just talking about video games, like one of the things that I wanted as I wrote it is so the book opens with these four banished adventurers that are being kicked out of a city. And they sort of travel to this area. They're kicked out of the city of Joymon, which is kind of a city-state in the northwestern part of the world of the Ark, which I've written like a ton of novels in. This was where I run all my Dungeons and Dragons campaigns out of, and it's a highly developed world that I've been working on for 20 years. It's got languages and regions and trade and legends and mythology and everything like that. I love this kind of stuff. I do an intense amount of ripping off different mythologies to create my books. Like, as far as appropriation goes, like, I've always thought, you know, if it ain't tied down, it's mine now. And that, no apology, I will take absolutely anything. So in this book, these four people are banished for a different crime, and they're let go from the dungeons of the city if they promise to try and save the city. It's one of those things where they're hunkering down because they're about to be essentially under siege, and they're cutting loose all the people that they can't feed if they're willing to swear an oath to try and save the town. And of course, most people just get the hell out and they never look back. But two of the main characters are actually the nephews of the King of Joymont. And so as the book develops, you find out like a little bit more about what they might have done to get in, cast into the dungeon, I'd say. And so they go off far into the west, into a sort of border town where traders come to harvest the marvelous and deadly insects of this forest called the Kelparsimix. And in the book, it goes on about all the different medicines and resins and poisons and particularly painful insects that you can find. And there are, in the story, there are said to be insect masters that are just absolutely on point with finding all the most irritating insects. And there's all varieties. There are ear ticks that are used to punish convicts. It's a tick in the mythology of this world. These are ticks that take like a year to come off of somebody. Like, they'll bite someone and burrow into their skin and start injecting slow, super painful poison. And it's one of those things where if you just yank this guy out or burn it off like a regular tick, you'll die. Mm-hmm. And it takes almost a year for the tick to fall off. And during that entire time, somebody's in considerable agony just by the ministrations of this poison. And they have crotch mites and adder wasps and all. There's a neat...
All kinds of fun stuff
that you could get by tangling with an insect master. And so the town of Ten is set up in the caldera of a very, like, very much sort of still active volcano. And because it's surrounded by... it's at a high altitude, and the caldera is fairly hot. So a lot of the insects can't really make it in to fool around in this town. Completely surrounding it is a forest that's described as a total pandemonium of insects. Insects are the apex predators. They're the dominant forms of life. There's no mammalian life that's able to survive, and the book deals a lot with that ecology. So your four adventurers wander into this area in search of a cure for this pestilence, and I describe it as if you've ever been playing a video game, and like an RPG, like Final Fantasy or something like that, and you wander into a zone that you're not supposed to be in, where every single monster can kick your party's ass and kill everybody and like take all your gold or zennies or whatever. That's the experience of the four banished adventurers as they step into the Kelparsimix. They are completely outclassed. They're lured into the jungle by this cursed sorceress, Ink, and they are sort of thwarted by a legendary ranger, Zan. So these are the two titular characters of Zan and Ink, and completely caught up in the cat and mouse between these two. So yeah, it winds up being like a pretty dark and interesting story. Mm-hmm. Nobody gets out unscathed. Everybody has changed.
Now, this is from, again, Gut Punch Press.
Yep. This is our third title that we're putting out. Mm-hmm. So we're moving on up there.
And it's available probably not in too many brick-and-mortar stores.
No. So we'll have... Well, I think we're actually going to have distribution through Ingram Spark. So it's possible.
So it would be.
It's possible that you can find Xananic in a store, but ultimately, just about everybody will probably just pick it up on Amazon, and that'll be the end of it. You can actually pick up
a Powell's.
Yeah, they're absolutely.
I use Amazon,
but anything you can do to slow down the roll of the evil empire, by all means. So I don't think we'll have like a lot of brick and mortar distribution for this one, unless it goes crazy. You never know. But
have you done an ebook? Are you going to?
Yeah, we're gonna have. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we'll have an ebook. The ebook is great, actually. We're just finishing the design of the EPUB, but there are, I want to say, just about 90 illustrations in Xananic. Mm. All of our chapter headers are different sort of illustrations of insects, just going with the whole jungle theme. And there are a lot of ink splotches and splatters throughout the book. We really put like some time into the typesetting. I hear the typesetter is super handsome. Just a great guy,
and the
physical book.
Tests in the middle
it really is like extreme. I could open to a page here. So our cover designer is a guy called Adam Priester, called that because it's his name, and it's his thing is designed by Priester. But I found this guy's stuff on Reddit, and I was like, oh my god, I've got to get him for a cover. And it was just the guy posting his stuff. And I went through the thread, and turns out that he's from Scandinavia. And I don't want to say the country because I can't 100% remember. And, you know, they hate each other like poison over there.
Yeah.
The Swedes want to kill the Finns, and the Finns just busy murderous rampage.
Yeah.
And the Denmark is down there plotting against everybody else.
Oh, what's the northernmost? Is it Svetland?
Yeah. I haven't seen this. Is
there's
it just like an
that
island?
That's even.
Is that like Novaya Zemlya? And like I have in my shower, I've got a shower curtain that has like the map of the world on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wind up, because it's right at my eye level, the very top of the map there is a little island, chain of islands or whatever, called Novaya Zemlya. So I think.
No, I think
that's in Russia.
It's this is, well, I mean, it could be considered, I think it's considered part of Europe, but then again, parts of Russia are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Within
is this something that we should just know? Are we just revealing how American we are at this moment? Like,
yes.
Oh, God.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I
got into a conversation recently where I couldn't place Belize on a map. And,
yes.
I was close. I was close, but not close enough, really. Like, I knew that it was near Guatemala, but I was completely wrong. I thought it was between Guatemala and in any case, I could just see the face of my geography teacher from eighth grade just kind of slowly falling, and their disappointment with me mounting as I struggled to explain where Belize was to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
We should know these things, you know? I don't know what it is in people where it's difficult to keep the whole map of the world in your mind, but I feel like I should know. It's a great personal feeling. Like, I wish I was one of those guys that could just draw the entire world map, like that one cat that just draws out the map.
By the time you finish it,
it'll be different. Yeah.
Yeah. Michael Palin had done a tour of Europe. And then 10 years later had to do another series called Michael Palin's New Europe.
Oh, wow.
And by now it's totally out of date. And that was only like 6 years ago that he did it.
What a world we live in, I'll tell you the truth there.
You know, my mother lived in Czechoslovakia.
Which is no more,
yeah. Czech Republic, there's Slovakia, but there's no Czechoslovakia.
And I think recently, like... I don't know if it was Slovakia, but I know one of maybe Bosnia and Serbia, or probably just Bosnia, recently applied for the EU membership, and they're pushing it through there. So just a lot of changes going to be happening through this. They're exciting changes, but just shout out to the Czech Republic, by the way. I love Prague. I had a fantastic time there.
Prague is a favorite of fantasy writers for a good reason.
You know,
aside from so much great literature came out of Prague.
So much great art, so much great literature, and
Kafka.
Just all the for fantasy writer, just going into the catacombs, basically into these smoky bars where everybody is blazed out of their minds on incredible weed, and as well, like there are like furs hanging on these stone walls and scones and sconces and suits of armor and stuff like that. It really is kind of a wonderland over there, and you can drink all night for 10 euros. So if you were looking for a place to go and act out your medieval fantasies, I highly recommend Prague.
Okay.
Super solid.
Well, my mother lived there for years, so but I've never gone to...
You've got to go. Got to go.
Yeah, well, it takes money.
That's...
I don't have the money. You know, somebody wants to send me to...
teleporters. They're getting closer every day.
Well,
6 miles, I think 6 kilometers away they were teleporting.
I have been wanting my teleporter. I'm very annoyed that it isn't here yet. Good morning, Lester. Speaking of teleporters,
yeah.
So let's see. We have about 6 minutes left.
6 minutes left.
Yeah, which can be a lot or a little. What other you have? Well, this is your first novel.
Novel.
It's not your first book in print.
No, it's not. Actually, I have a short novella called Survival Mode. And Survival Mode is something that's been much on my mind recently. Recently, I've been watching like a lot of Sam Harris talks about AI. Elon Musk and Sam Harris have both kind of like hoisted this petard that AI is quite dangerous and will have drastic consequences. And this is something that I've always...
This has been making...
it's been making the rounds. Recently. And I honestly believe that there's a lot to what they're saying there. I think AI is definitely something that we should be extremely careful of, and I also believe that it doesn't really matter how careful we are, because the incentive to develop strong AI is so powerful. It's one of those things where, just like nuclear weapons, where somebody's going to do it, and as soon as one person does it, everybody has to do it. And the thing about AI is I don't think that it is anywhere near as containable or controllable as a nuclear arsenal. And the ramifications are every bit as deadly.
Well, it's certainly always been one of the biggest themes in science fiction since day one.
Absolutely.
With
Metropolis,
there's a robot in there, mm-hmm. but it's not AI per se. Well, she is controlled.
Mm-hmm.
She's largely controlled, and it was never the intention of the writer
to make her be sentient.
Von Harbaugh.
Yeah.
She is sort of sentient, but she isn't an artificial intelligence. Yeah. It's not what they were thinking of.
So, anyhow, to sort of loop back to the book
thinking
there,
of Colossus, the key, Farming Project,
sort of the key. One of the key points of Survival Mode is that the main character, Kay, is a fugitive who's trying to ride out the statute of limitations at relativistic speeds. Mm-hmm. He's hopped in a one-way spacecraft, and he's just trying to make a big loop and come back, hopefully when the heat has died down a little bit. But he crash lands on an alien world instead because he bought a cheap, junky spaceship. And he crash lands onto an alien world and has to survive in these conditions. It's sort of a survival narrative in the same way that The Martian is. If Mark Watney had a laser and just blasted everything in sight. Yeah, a little bit more. And
I would call it in the Sheckley mode.
Yeah. So, so one of the key points there is the sort of continual narrative between Kay and his survival suit. He doesn't know how much he can trust the AI in the survival suit, whether it's on his side, whether it's only concerned with its own survival, whether it sees him as an impediment. And that's one of the big driving dramas of the story there. And, of course, there's tons of weird monsters and crazy inventions.
One would hope. I've read it. Book, actually.
Yeah. So. How'd you like it, Dare?
I loved it. Yeah. I had a lot of fun with it.
That's
I thought
fantastic.
It was too short.
So I'm... we will probably...
I shouldn't say that because I'm a big fan of short fiction.
Survival Mode is it's a short novella. And it was just written to sort of put something out so people can be like, oh, okay, this guy might be able to write something.
Was that,
if we
was
let
that
him.
The inaugural book of Gut Print?
We put out Derby Life first. And then we put out Survival Mode. And we've gotten a great response to Survival Mode. Just about everybody I know who's read it, even people that aren't afraid of me personally, that could tell me that, like, if they don't like it, have been like, yeah, this is fantastic. So it was really great.
And for people who are trying to look this stuff up, you spell Zach ZYZ's name.
Yeah, it's just
ZYZ.
ZYZ. So
yeah, I mean,
you can do a search for Zach ZYZ and it'll pull you to my webpage.
But you know what? If you're you know, at a bookseller and you want to do a search, I think if you put in ZYZ, you're not going to have that many hits on that last name.
It's me and a guy that sells fitness equipment. So it shouldn't be too hard. Yeah. But yeah, like, so Survival Mode is, every so often we'll do like a free promotion for it as well. It's a short read and, I enjoyed it there. Yeah. I think you'll have a good time with Spaceman K, who flew the wrong way, which was a title that I could not get. I'm sorry. I tried really hard, guys. My editor would not take.
It could be the lead. It could be the, you know, the subtitle.
I have so many terrible pun titles that I've tried to get through for Survival Mode. I want the sequel to be A Good K to Die, but no, it's not going to happen.
And on that note, not quite. Well, we have a whole minute left.
Okay.
But so those are the two books, Survival Mode and...
Xanon Inc.
Z-A-N.
Or X-A-N.
Sorry.
No worries at all.
X-A-N.
X-A-N.
You see, it's your Inc. first name that's throwing me off. I mean, spell Zach, by the way, Z-A-K.
Yeah. My love of confusing people will just be the end of me when I have to actually market these things there. Because I love confusion and
you
discord.
You just want your name to come up in a spelling
book. So it really is just, I worked at a used bookstore for a number of years, and some people start browsing at the front, at the A's, and some people start at the Z's, and I figured I could be the last name in science fiction.
There you go. Unless somebody comes up with ZZZ, but then they're going to be asleep.
That person will have to fight me for that.
Yeah.
I'll throw down on this, yeah.
Yeah, that's it, but they'd be asleep. So, we do have to outro at this point. We are at that time. So I think, do you have a website that people
can... actually, you can go to www.zackzyz.com, and it's mainly, you can buy the books there, you can see what I'm working on, and it is just a ton of weird abstract painting that I'm doing as well. So Jim, thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. So everybody listening, this has been Hour of the Wolf. Thank you. I will not be here next week, nor the week after. Next week, because I'm preempted for fundraising drive. The week after, because I will be at Capclave, which is a favorite convention of mine. ReaderCon and Capclave are basically the two solid that I do every year. After that, who knows? I should be back here pitching my rear off to make money for the station. Or not. We'll discuss it with management. In the meantime, again, this has been Hour of the Wolf. You can visit the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. You have to join it, but don't cost nothing. Or OurWolf.com on the web, although it's so out of date. And you can write me, Jim@OurWolf.com. And I'll be back soon enough, anyway. Or maybe. And in the meantime, everybody, be good to each other because you deserve it, and they deserve it, and we all deserve it. Have a good time, and we'll be talking soon. Good morning.
this.
And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
America, the red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth put on hold. The bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the peace work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too.
So what?
and burn.
WBAI 99.5. Lister on the radio here until, let's see. Lister on the radio until 5 o'clock. Felipe Luciano returns on a Friday to WBAI. That's nice. This is where we burn the imperious red, white, and blue.
I can't do a thing like that. Shaming the game. Always oppressing our backs. Shaming the game. Shaming the game. I'm slices down now. Instead you tell
be a cop, they can only be great dancers.
Listen.
When the whole police department was white, justice was the Black Panthers.
Listen.
We've been robbed of our religion, our government and social position.
Listen.
And you won't see no quick solution until you see the Black Revolution. But when them come to arrest us, by the hour, cause the Black man in the ghetto has power. If he would wake up and unite, the police department would lose the fight. But when them come to arrest a Black man, they need 30 cops or more. Well now, when they arrest a Black man, they need 30 cops or more. Well now, hey,
listen.
If you a Black herb smuggler, they will watch you by